the last few hundred years. That now, because of this, the level of crisis within the colonial capitalist system, we are seeing the internal contradictions in the U.S. that were glossed over and managed for many years. Now they are no longer being able to be managed. Now they are coming to the surface. And we're seeing this in the politics of this country and the division between elements of the ruling class and the decisions being made by all elements of the ruling class to systematically move away from their commitment to even the shell of democracy here in this country. So it's a very dangerous situation we face, one of which is quite clear that the ruling elements have decided that they're going to use force and militarism, and in fact will be prepared to engage in a fascist configuration if necessary in order to maintain their dominant positions in the society and in this system. Very dangerous.
Yeah, and I think it's also dangerous because in this appeal to nationalism and this appeal to basically white nationalism and white supremacy, they seem to be enlisting this extreme right wing, primarily white males, who seem to have heard this kind of wolf whistle, basically, that in order for us to maintain this position, and they want to recruit, you know, working class white men as if they are soldiers or, you know, part of that whole struggle in order to kind of maintain some semblance of white supremacy around the globe. We want to recruit you in this effort to not only repress people abroad in the military, but also here at home. You know, that our survival depends on this militarism. I think that it's not stated explicitly, but I think that that's somewhere in the messaging in conservative media, Christian media, all kinds of media that is appealing to the extreme right.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is part of the neo-fascist playbook, that as the capitalist system continues to deteriorate, they have to use convenient scapegoats. And because the core value of the colonial capitalist system is rests on the notion of white supremacy, the scapegoats, the targets, tend to be non-European populations. Before Jewish people became white, it was the Jews in Europe. Now it is so-called people of color and black people in the U.S. That these are the ones that are the internal enemies, the ones responsible for the deterioration of your lifestyles. That these people who are using resources from the state in order to prop up their lifestyle, you know, taking advantage of so-called welfare, those people who are coming across the border illegally in order to take your jobs and to drive down wages, the ones, these people who are going to basically end up subordinating white people so that white people now are the new victims of discrimination. And these messages are resonating with certain elements of the population, but this is part of that playbook. And that's what makes this moment so critically dangerous, because there is a ideological basis for a cross-class white united front that's not being confronted by other white folks who claim to be our allies. In fact, we see, you know, these elements associated with the Democratic Party surrendering more and more ideological space to those right-wing elements, that they are not confronting issues of white supremacy, they're not confronting issues of the distorted version of U.S. history. They are suggesting to these elements that, in fact, it is these internal issues and contradictions that have to be addressed. You know, let's not talk about issues of race, because that's so-called identity politics. So is a very dangerous ideological space right now, and a lot of political confusion that has the consequence of providing ideological support to these more extremist elements. You know, right now we get focused on the more dramatic expressions of white supremacist groups and activities. But I'm even more concerned about the normalized white supremacy that is reflected in the neoliberal sector, the Democrats, the centrist Democrats that are also white supremacists upholding white power, who are, have been given a political pass, but who are responsible for some of the more aggressive moves towards strengthening the U.S. state and limiting the access to critical information and analysis. So, you know, this is a new conditions and new situation that we are facing here in this country, and it's very, very dangerous for all of us who are non-white and who are members of the working class, or who stand with working class people here in this country and internationally.
Yeah, and I guess speaking of internationally, just this week, of course, you have the Speaker of the House not allowing a vote on a war powers measure, which is the responsibility of Congress, that would basically end funding in U.S. support for this genocidal war or attack in Yemen. And I think that Ro Khanna, who is one of the backers of the measure, said that this was the first time that he knew of that the Congress was prevented from voting on a measure around war powers, because this is the power of Congress, it's the responsibility of Congress, yet the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, prevented this from coming to the floor for a vote. And in the meantime, you have 14 million people starving. I know people keep saying on the brink of starvation, but no, there are millions of people starving right now and dying in Yemen. And then you have this inaction by Congress.
And it's obscene and immoral. And it's something that's been going on for a few years now. And it's only been in the last few months that there's been any penetration into the corporate media related to this issue in Yemen. But the reason why they are playing the kind of games they're playing in Congress right now with the War Powers Act and with the situation with Yemen is because they have very powerful forces and they don't want anything to change. The Saudis are major players when it comes to purchasing U.S. armaments. And because of that, you're talking about billions of dollars in play. They don't want to do anything to undermine that relationship between U.S. defense industries and the Saudi authorities, even though now politically it's becoming a bit of a problem. So both of these parties play these kinds of games. This is about big money. It's about billions of dollars in defense sales. It's about satisfying the regional needs of a major ally in that part of the world. And it doesn't really matter to them if millions of people, in fact, starve in the process. We remember what Madeleine Albright said when asked about the issue of half a million children dying in Iraq as a consequence of U.S. sanctions. And she said that she thought that it was worth the price.
Speaking of her, I mean, didn't mean to cut you off, but I was just really astounded that she came out with a book. Madeleine Albright comes out with a book warning about fascism related to Trump. And it's almost as if they have no consciousness of the fact that they themselves have been actively engaged in this fascist project around the world. Like, what do they call it? What do they call what they did?
They call it a democracy. But that's part of the challenge, to expose those contradictions, to for people to understand that the Democrats are not going to be anyone's savior because they are part of the problem. They're representing the same kind of dominant interests. And so, yeah, it is appalling that they take these kinds of positions, these hypocritical positions, and they don't get called out more than they have been. And they don't get called out because their worldviews, their interests, their values are mirrored and reflected in the corporate media. So there's a connection there that seems at this point to be unbreakable.
Speaking of the Democrats, it occurred to me, and this might have been a conversation I had, you know, during the election, was that the main difference between what the Republicans and the Democrats was always, if you really listen very carefully to what Hillary Clinton was saying and what the Democrats were saying, even people who supported her, is that they were willing to keep supporting the fascist project abroad. In other words, you can keep on doing what you're doing in Yemen, in Syria, in Libya, in Africa, you know, you can keep on doing that. You can keep repressing those folks abroad, but don't do it here. And like, that was the only thing that the Democrats offered differently, that they thought they were offering people the fact that we would be less repressive here at home. And so many of even African-American people who supported them, it's that, to me, that's what they were saying, that, okay, these people are going to be less repressive toward me, but they were willing to accept the repression that we were of people abroad.
Well, you know, I think that you're absolutely right. And that's really one of the other contradictions of politics in the U.S., that one can fashion themselves a progressive or even a radical and have a purely U.S.-centric perspective and political stance. So you will be more concerned about the conditions in the U.S. And silent about U.S. imperialism, and still can project yourself as a so-called progressive. Now, that has to be exposed. But basically, we have certain responsibilities in this country as citizens and residents of empire. And part of our responsibility is connected to our common humanity. It is an immoral position, in my opinion, for people who call themselves progressives to remain silent on the criminal activities that this state is engaged in support of the capitalist ruling class around the world. So that's part of the issue we have to deal with. That basically, African Americans have moved toward the right along with everybody else in this country, as a consequence of the Obama administration or the Obama experience. And what we have to do now, what we're trying to do in trying to rebuild an anti-war and anti-imperialist movement in this country, is to reverse that process to the extent that we can. That's why we had the Peace Congress last weekend. That's why we are building the Black Alliance for Peace. That's why we are going to Dublin to build this global a campaign to close all U.S. and NATO bases. We are getting ourselves positioned to try to inject some morality and some authentic progressive politics back into the public domain, because we have to. Because we don't put a brake on these forces, they're going to drive all of us to, in essence, they're going to drive these forces are going to drive all of us basically to a point where the human population on this planet will be extinct.
Yes, yes. And I wanted to just emphasize what you were saying around new narratives, because I know that just in terms of talking about Gaza, for example, I guess it was around the time of the beginning of the Great March of Return and the just weekly slaughter of unarmed protesters, I did a poem about it. And just the reception, I could tell people were so uncomfortable when I was at a public space, you know, reading it. It was one thing at a kind of gathering of more activists, but just kind of like the general public at a similar type of gathering, you know, a white woman approached me and she said, "Aren't you afraid to say things like that?" So obviously people aren't hearing a variety of narratives, just like they only heard one narrative around the so-called caravan of people, refugees coming to this country, you know, but they don't really know that much about Honduras. They don't know about Berta Cáceres. They don't know, you know, all the things that have produced that type of misery, you know, in Honduras.
You know, but that kind of lack of awareness, that kind of innocence, if you will, cannot be allowed to continue. I mean, because there's a luxury that the people of the world cannot afford.
Right.
Because this state is responsible for so much suffering, so much death and destruction. We can't allow ourselves to be concerned about people's fragile consciousness. They've got to be hit right in the face with the reality of what their state is doing and forced to take a stance.
Right. And that reminds me of, and I know I'm running out of time, but not long after the Iraq War ended, and I think there was a kind of like a people's, there have been a few different ones. Code Pink had a people's tribunal on the Iraq War, but this was before that. And I think that Phil, former TV host, had a gathering here at one of the Friends Center Quaker Meeting House. And they had several soldiers testifying, talking about how they naively went to Iraq thinking that it had something to do with 9/11, that it had something to do with that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, and that while they were there, they became more aware and they became increasingly disillusioned. And I couldn't help but feel, sitting there, the way what you just expressed, that we really can't afford to have, you know, another contingent or regiment of soldiers go abroad thinking that they're fighting for freedom or fighting for to bring democracy or whatever, and then months later, after millions more have died, then say, oh, I didn't know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, we just can't. We, you know, those people over there can't afford that. We can't afford it here. What, 58% of every dollar I pay in federal taxes is going to fund the military? Even that is painful to me.
Exactly. I mean, it's obscene that not just 58%, now it's going up like 61% of the budget is now being devoted toward the military. We look at that at $1.2 trillion now almost every year when you add all of it together. So it's obscene. And that money is being taken out of our pockets and put right in the pockets of the defense contractors.
Right, right. You know, speaking of abroad and the U.S. interventions abroad, tell me about your concern about AFRICOM, what that is, and your petition drive.
You know, part of our responsibility as we rebuild this anti-war movement here in this country is to bring a particular focus on how U.S. war policies impact Black people specifically, not just here in the U.S., which is important, the war being waged against Black and brown working class people here in this country, but also its impact globally. So what we're doing to make that connection between the war in the U.S. and the war being waged externally, we have a focus in on the African continent and the U.S. Africa Command, or better known as AFRICOM, that we are calling on the U.S. to shut down the Africa Command and to withdraw from the African continent. We've seen that as a consequence of the growing presence of the U.S. on the Africa continent, that we've seen an escalation of violence on the continent. And you can look at and talk about the invasion of Libya and the destruction of that state, the ongoing conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You know, there are many, many hot spots, if you will, that have now been sort of facilitated by U.S. militarism. So we have a petition. We're trying to get people to sign the petition calling on the U.S. to withdraw from Africa, but calling on the Congressional Black Caucus, who is now in a stronger position as a consequence of the Democrats winning the elections, to organize hearings to look at the impact of the Africa Command on the African continent. So we want people to sign the petition. You can go to our website, blackalliancefor.com, to sign the petition, and you can support us in this effort.
I've been speaking with Ajamu Baraka, human rights activist and national coordinator for Black Alliance for Peace. He was a nominee for Vice President of the United States for the Green Party in 2016. Thank you for joining me today, Ajamu.
My pleasure.
And Ajamu Baraka will have the last word on today's show. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on Pacifica Radio. The music we played this hour included Rain Dance by Nana Vasconcelos and the Bush Dancers, and Shalia by the Ether Orchestra. The veterans you heard speaking earlier in the show were speaking on November 11th, 2018, near the National Mall and the many national war memorials. You can write us at our website. We love to hear from you. If you are a listener and are on Facebook, please like our Facebook page, On the Ground Show. Our page has a picket sign with green letters that say On the Ground. We're also on Twitter and on iTunes under the title WPFW On The Ground. And if you listen on podcast, please give us a nice review. We very much appreciate it. I'm Esther Avaram. Until next time, keep raising your voice. Peace.
The time is 12 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, November 19th, 2018. Tomorrow is World Children's Day, and to honor the occasion, Amnesty International is challenging the ongoing policy of imprisoning immigrant families by the Trump administration. Specifically, the group is calling for all children held at the Dilley Detention Center in South Texas to be freed with their families and for the USA to end its plan of expanding family detention centers. The South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas is currently the largest immigration detention center in the U.S., holding hundreds of families. The head of Amnesty said the U.S. government could release those families while they pursue their asylum claims, but instead has chosen to lock up children with their parents for exercising their human rights and seeking asylum. The group is also calling for the release of 1,100 unaccompanied minors held at another Texas detention camp. In California, the death toll from two major wildfires has climbed to 80, with about 1,000 people still missing as firefighters continue to battle the fires. Now, experts